Yoga Vasishtha, Part 13, Seeds of the Mind, Prana or Life Force, and Vasana or Mental Conditioning, and Unminding the Mind by Swami Surya Devananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time, and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness, which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge, and known, seer, sight, and seeing, doer, doing, and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. The last time, we talked about six simple ways to transform existing rajas and tamas into sattva. Let us briefly review these six simple ways. 1. Inquire into your own true nature and of this universe. Who am I? And how has this universe arisen? And remain indifferent to it. 2. Avoid unworthy company, conduct, and inactivity. 3. Remember the all-devouring death. 4. Abandon identification of the self or the infinite consciousness with the body composed of flesh and bones. 5. Inwardly, behold the consciousness that knits together all beings that exist in the universe. And 6. Engage yourself in the inquiry into the nature of reality in the company of holy ones. Our topics today include Seeds for the Mind, and in this we will talk about the two seeds of the mind, prana or life force and vasana or mental conditioning. That would be the first half. Then we would talk about bringing about change in the second part called Unminding the Mind, under which we'll talk about four topics: spiritual discipline, avoiding carelessness, samsara, and equanimity. Let us begin. The seeds for samsara, or world appearance, and the mind. Let us first look into the seeds of samsara and then focus on the two seeds for the mind. Greetings. Why are we here? How did we get here? Well, before we get into all these big questions, let us look at some things that are obvious. The seed for this samsara or world experience is the body. If we did not have the body, if we were not born, samsara would not be an issue. Now, we will discuss samsara a little bit later in the second half of our time today. But let's get back to the seed. In this birth, you may have good conditions in this particular life, but there's no telling what conditions you may have later on or what conditions you may have had earlier. There's no telling about that. This, my friends, is not a negative view as such of things, but very practical thinking. If you look at the mix of everybody, the haves, the have-nots, the amount of suffering in the world, and some people born into conditions of affluence, and some people born into conditions where there is great lacking. Well, my friends, you can't explain this, and we're not going to try to get too much into it, but there's no telling what conditions we may have been born into, or the conditions that we may be born into in the future. So it makes sense to try and understand why this is happening in the first place and see if we can put an end to this. Friends, we are not here either as a challenge or a punishment of any kind, but we are here to work out the obstacles in our realization of our true nature. These obstacles have not been put here by someone else or some other force, but by our own self, because these obstacles are within us, within our own awareness, within our own consciousness, within our own mind. We have made them up, we have fortified them in the erroneous hope that they may give us eternal joy, lasting joy, peace, and all these wonderful things, that they will help us. But instead, they restrict us, limit, eclipse, and overshadow the grandeur of our true nature. We have become preoccupied, my friends, with harnessing what we call potential. But in this unexamined outrush, forget that we are already far more that can be harnessed. It's not what we are capable of, it is what we are in our true nature. And all capabilities rest in that true nature. The realization of our true nature is infinitely greater than the harnessing of any potential. As potential, all potential flows from our true nature. So it makes sense to realize our true nature is to realize what we call the rock bed, the very heart of all potential, from where all potential arises. Let us sharpen the focus a little bit. The seeds of samsara, or this journey through what we call transmigration, one life after another, are the seeds of the mind. And there are two of them, according to Vishishta. The movement of prana, or life force, and vasana, or mental conditioning. These two will be our focus in the first half today. To put it in a simpler way, let's put it in a very simple, concise sentence. When energy moves over conditioning, latent conditioning, it becomes alive. It becomes animated. It appears so very real because energy is moving over impressions, and all of this is in consciousness itself. So it's a very slippery slope. This animation happens within the same consciousness of being or ourself, and therefore it appears so very real, and the conditioned mind reacts. This is, to put it in a nutshell. But if life is lived wisely, we will use the outer to work out the inner, which is all these self-imposed limitations, and make the most of it. If we only live life for the outer, to build affluence, to have a better standard of living, for all of that, and pay no attention to the inner, we lose a great deal. Now, for this, the mind has to be watched relentlessly and without remission. As the mind, dominated by hopes and desires of fruits, is the past, is the seed for samsara, for this body and our journey through this samsara. So if we don't put an end to it, if we don't check it at that stage, this is going to continue. Life cannot be lived with any lesser goal as the root of all samsara, of all sorrow, which disallows joy, is strengthened if we are calloused in this department. But if life is lived with self-realization as the goal, each life would progressively exhaust experience while lessening conditioning and increasing our spiritual ascent. This, my friends, is a win-win principle. It's not a complete withdrawal from life. It's not an only inner life. It's looking at the whole package together. Can we live life with self-realization as the goal? And if we do, can we go through experiences without increasing our desires, but exhausting them? That means to go through them wisely. Exhaust experience, lessen conditioning, not go through experience and increase our conditioning, all of our likes and dislikes and all of that, then a great deal has been missed. And at the same time, increase our spiritual ascent. If we can do it this way, we've done really well. The choice lies along these lines. As beneath all of this, there is a reality, there is a truth, there is infinity, which is not distinct from our true nature. Can we live life for the realization of this goal? Our true nature. And in that, these three things come up. Live life to exhaust experience without the building up urges for new experience of any sort. Build life to lessen conditioning, and build life to contribute to our spiritual growth. A great one once said, "The only choice that we have before us is to face the light or to face darkness." Friends, if the goal of self-realization is not embraced in the heart early on, other goals take root and they firm themselves, and then it becomes very difficult to bring about real change in the heart, which is essential for peace, for joy, and for fulfillment that endures. First seed for samsara, prana or life force. When life force moves along the subtle channels of psychic force, awareness and experience arises and mental activity commences. You know, my friends, that we need energy for anything. When energy flows over something, a reaction happens. Just like if you have a gadget of some sort and it has a program in it. When energy flows over that, something else happens. It comes alive, whether it's a little gadget or a computer or a radio or a television or whatever else. It's programmed to do certain things. When energy flows over that circuit, something comes alive. So, it is through this that awareness exists everywhere, but it's all activated by the life force. It is the extension of experience that leads to countless other experiences and to great sorrow. The extension of that experience which is extended by conditioning, by all of our likes and dislikes, when it is modified, given a little twist, that's where all the problems arise. If this awareness rests in itself as if asleep, they say, one attains the supreme state. Restraining the movement of prana does not mean completely subduing breath, but being very aware that the same energy that animates breath also animates all of these things called vasanas, which are these latent impressions which come alive in the mind. So restraining the movement of prana prevents the expansion of the field of objective experience. We are not going to deny objective experience, but we are talking about that expansion of the objective world. That objective world, whatever is out there, is expanded by our vasanas, by our conditioning, and made out to be something other than it is. We see a person coming, and all of a sudden our conditioning adds to that situation, that person is coming, or this person is coming. I like this person, or I don't like that person. The I like, and I don't like, and this person, and that person is not part of the equation. A person is coming. It's as simple as that. So can we learn to deal with what is in its simplest sense, without all these add-ons? For that, obviously, we've got to learn how to control these add-ons. All these add-ons are latent impressions that are powered or energized by the energy that we call prana. So prana is not just breath and subduing breath, but the other thing that prevents the expansion of latent impressions. That is the key. So just as seeds do not generate in dry soil, so also all these latent impressions or vasana do not gain strength until they have a unrestricted link to prana. Prana or life force makes the vasanas or impressions come alive and makes them seem so very real. Therefore, my friends, the practice of pranayama, yogic breathing, control of yogic breathing, or regulation, should we say, of yogic breathing, is among other things the practice of letting the energy flow where it is needed, where it is essential, and not to vasana. It's as simple as that. Just like if you have a river that flows down and it's needed to water a field, say that. But there are several other channels that have been cut somehow when it rained last, and water could escape going here and there, and very little water could reach the field. The purpose of that water is to irrigate and reach the field. But water gets drained out, should we say, in other channels, and other flooding and all of that results. So engineers would carefully work this out, that the water doesn't go where it's not needed and the water goes where it is needed. The practice of regular pranayama enables one to attain peace of mind, supreme equanimity, happiness, blessedness, and a healthy experience or awareness by conservation of energy and weakening conditioning. Conditioning cannot do anything without energy any more than, say, a radio or your computer or something like that can go someplace without power, without a power source. It cannot do anything without it. There are two elements to it: prana or life force, and vasana or latent depressions or conditioning. These two have to come together, and there has to be carelessness, which is us not being aware of this going on and therefore letting it go on. This is at the root of all of our suffering, of all of our problems. Not conditions out there, but conditions in here. Friends, we cannot do a whole lot about things out there. It's raining today, or it's not raining today, or whatever. But we can, and we should, do something about what's in here. So control of prana will lead to control of the mind by depleting it of its energy. They're still breathing, the body still gets perfect energy. Matter of fact, it gets better energy by deeper breathing and well-regulated breathing. But having control over that process prevents the energy from dissipating into channels that are not suitable for us. You cannot just drain the energy from the mind, because the energy channels or habit pathways will continue to replenish them. So what needs to happen, my friends, is a two-part process. We work on the energy, and we work on cutting new channels where we want this energy to flow. The energy that we are regulating, the energy that we are allowing to go into proper channels properly. So it is this on one end, guiding the energy properly, and on the other end, making sure it does not go unregulated. A two-pronged approach is necessary. You have to deplete residual energy, and you have to cut new grooves or new pathways in the mind which are conducive to your aspiration. So the energy is not flowing towards habit that we want to overcome, but it's flowing towards aspiration. Remember, my friends, the same energy that allows us to walk and eat and digest our food and do so many wonderful things is also the energy that animates the mind, with all of its habits, desires, and all of that. There are not two kinds of energy. There's just one. It has different subtle levels. On a grosser level, it helps us with digestion, all the other stuff, walking, running, coming, going, all of that. On a subtle level, a part of it animates the mind, all of the things that we have in the mind. So working on it at that level helps us work on the mind in a very deep way. Lack of focus on cutting new pathways leads to these habitual pathways getting stronger. No action, by default, powers or enables that which is not conducive to our aspiration, peace, happiness, and joy. Just as water seeks the path of least resistance, the mind's energy will also flow towards our likes and dislikes and rouse them up into vehemence. Remember, it's hard to fight it when it's already flowing down there, and if we are careless, because these get activated. And there's a lot of confusion when they do, because that's a part of us, it's happening within us. There are likes, there are dislikes. So before likes and dislikes, we have this word our. So our or us is trying to fight with or regulate our on that side, and it becomes very difficult. It becomes a very slippery slope. And that's why pranayama and several practices that we have in yoga help you tremendously. Because first of all, you see very clearly and you allow a better, deeper energy to go where it's needed in our breathing towards all the functions that the body and mind needs. And the vigilance that ensues or that goes along with it prevents the energy from going there. Now, I mentioned earlier, my friends, there's a two-part action. Not only does it not go there, but we put the energy where we need to go, which is in what we are doing, which are the things that are in our best interests. See, my friends, for all this, for meaningful change, there must be first a real change of heart to do this. This is necessary and essential. Now, my friends, let us talk about the second seed for samsara, which is vasana or mental conditioning. The mind arises from the seed of vasana or mental conditioning. And this is why it is so tricky and slippery within. Vasana or mental conditioning develops strength when one perceives an object on the basis of one's conviction without inquiring into it at all. Just like the example we've been using again and again and again. A person rubs you wrong, say while you were going to the water fountain or something else, just rude to you or doesn't return your greeting or something of that kind while you were at your office. Okay. The next day, you see the person, but you don't see the person, you see that person. So every time when one does not inquire, no, it's not that person, it's this person. If you don't set things right by being alert and awake in the moment, vasana strengthens. We have a small conviction which we gather, and if the mind is not watching this process, the mind goes to the conviction, even though there is a situation outside which is disconnected from that conviction. The mind will lump all these together and present you these package deals and say, that person is coming. So all these notions, my friends, when the firmness of these notions are held in our consciousness or in our heart with great intensity, it appears real. That's why we've got to be very careful about the things we hold in our heart. Notions are thus seen as real. And when notions are seen as real, there is delusion. Just like if you have a notion about that person. See, we have a notion that this person is rude. And we see that person coming. We no longer see that person coming. We see a rude person coming. But my friends, ask yourself, is it really a rude person? The person may have been rude yesterday. For whatever the reason, they may be having a hard day or whatever it might be. But is that a rude person? That's a person who may have behaved rudely yesterday. But is that a rude person? Does it make him or her a rude person as a label, permanent, established, and a done deal? There's a person. They may be coming to apologize. So that is delusion. Delusion is all these add-ons that are not part of the situation. Like an illusion, it's a delusion. We get deluded. Then they are seen as part of reality. When they are seen as part of reality, my friends, you may say, what's the harm in having all these labels? But we have a nature that is unconditioned, that is free. It is this nature, actually, my friends, that wants freedom, that wants you to be free, wants you to go on vacation and sometimes do nothing. What they say, let your hair down, relax, all of those things. That whole urge comes from an unconditioned truth of our being, which is a fact. But when we start accepting and embracing conditioning, we start abandoning our unconditioned mind, and our vision gets perverted more and more. This perversion is other versions of conditioning being added onto the mind. The mind starts telling you, this is not, I like, I don't like, I'm not happy, that will give me happy. And we suffer more and more and more. We think all of this conditioning will make our life easier, pleasant and good, but it works the other way. That is known as the mind, in which such perverse vision creates confusion between what is and what appears to be. So that this is all we are talking about. What is conditioning? What is at the base of this? We are talking about vasana. It's very important to understand this very thoroughly, so we don't get caught in its clutches and we're not out there nourishing the streams of vasana. When such perverse vision gains firm ground, gets established within, the restless mind comes into being. I must have, I must avoid, this is good, this is not good. That restless mind becomes the consciousness that functions in our day-to-day life. And this is what causes us to get stressed out. This is stress itself, my friends. We can't wait for the work week to be over so that we can let our hair down and relax and all the other stuff. This is at the seed of all of the other stuff. We shouldn't have to worry about it if we live our life wisely. If we are working out our conditioning and we are moving to the unconditioned mind, even in our work-to-day life, there would be no difference between Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday and a Sunday or a holiday or a day off. Because whether it's a work day or a weekend, we're doing the same thing. We're exhausting conditioning, we're increasing awareness, and we're resting more and more, or coming closer and closer to our true nature. Whether you do that in the office, or you do that in the factory, or you do that at home, or you do that on your time on or time off, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? You're doing something for your highest good. You're also living life very carefully and not causing hurt and not hurting yourself. Now, this is a tremendous thing. While we do this, we are slowly putting an end, dialing out from this cycle of rebirth and the cycle of death. See, my friends, vasana has gained strength by repeated use, and it will weaken by disuse. Awakened living is living consciously, not by habit and not by rote, at each step of the way. As the inner intelligence or awareness is brought into play in our day-to-day life consciously, The habitual mind weakens. See, it's the choice between these two, awakened living and habitual living. Habitual living is not only the root of our sorrow, but it increases our sorrow. It strengthens our sorrow, grief, confusion, delusion, restlessness, all of that. So this is the choice that lies before us. Awakened living or habitual living. The habitual mind weakens in proportion to its disuse and the use of the inner intelligence at the same time. It's not only not using it and it's going to stay in a vacuum, because it's got energy. It has to be used. It has to be exhausted. So taking that energy instead and channeling it to our conscious mind and living life consciously, or an awakened life, or a life that's alert, or a vigilant life, draining the energy from what may not be conducive to our goals, to our aspiration, to our joy, to all of that, and living in such a way that promotes our joy. That is the yoga way. See, my friends, all sorrow and suffering is the result of unawakened living, or living habitually, living by habit. No matter what the allure, acceptance and encouragement by all as normal living. You may say, well, everybody lives that way. It doesn't make a difference. We're talking about how do you choose to live? What is the best examined way that you choose to live? True normal living is to live from the norm of our true nature, not to live from habit. This is something that lies before you. What they call normal living. What do we call normal living? At its very root, let's not talk about the outer in terms of work and how people act and dress and all of that. All of that stuff comes later on. All of that is far at the surface, at the very depth. True living is a living that reveals our true nature, that is akin to our true nature. For it to be akin to our true nature, or like our true nature, or from our true nature, we must know our true nature. So first, life has to be used to reveal our true nature. Life lived for any other purpose is a lesser goal, because all the other purposes are in time process. They are here today, they will not be there tomorrow. They are one way today, they will be another shape tomorrow. But our true nature is not in time process. See, my friends, your true nature when you were young and your true nature now, the habits and things might have changed, but just who you are as an essential person has not changed. You may have a different name. You may even change your name. You may change your passport. You may change all of the other things, but you cannot change who you are in its most fundamental sense. Even below the passport, below the names, you're aware that I'm a male or a female. So that awareness in you, that is aware of male and female, or that I'm a human being, has to be something quite different from that. What is that awareness? That is even aware that I'm a human being. It has to be something broader than that to say that this is a human being, that is an animal, this is a plant, this is a tree, this is the ocean, these are the winds. This is the white sky out there. That awareness is the same in all things. That awareness is limitless. That awareness is your true nature. To live in such a way that exhausts all these things that eclipse our true nature and that reveals our true nature is to live in the best way, in my opinion. Okay, my friends. We've talked about these two things, vasana, and we've talked about this thing called prana, and we talked about what happens when they come together. So what do we do about this? What are some simple ways to, in what we call, unmind the mind? Today we're going to talk about just four of them. One is spiritual discipline.
then avoiding carelessness, then samsara. It comes back over here again. We spoke about it as a problem earlier. Now we need to address it as a solution and equanimity.
Let us start with the first topic that we outlined for ourselves, spiritual discipline. Contrary to some misconceptions, the disciplined mind is not a stressed out mind or a stressed mind or a mind that is denied anything good. That is the key word out there. We are not talking about denying ourselves anything that is good for us. To deny ourselves anything that is not good for us is wisdom. And instead to choose something that is good for us is not just not only wisdom, but it's smart. The mind is offered what is good, wholesome, and conducive to its aspiration. And thus, it learns better choices instead of unexamined habits or the path of least resistance. See, my friends, this spirit is sustained by one's aspiration and self-discipline. And what is spiritual discipline? Spiritual discipline is that fire which forges potential into ability. And without this gain, not much has been gained. Therefore, it is never a loss because it's a movement from gain to gain. It's just like avoiding foods that may not be good for you and instead having something that you know is good for you. The undisciplined mind is the mind that is allowed and perhaps even encouraged to seek the path of least resistance. It is this undisciplined mind, my friends, that causes sorrow, and its cessation gives rise to joy immediately. See, my friends, happiness and joy are your true nature. The undisciplined mind disallows or prevents this joy by vehemently suggesting other things, this, that, and the other. It's those things that keep you from the joy of your true nature. Inner discipline works hand in hand with outer discipline. This battle, my friends, cannot be fought on one dimension only. Let us see how the mind becomes undisciplined, its effects, and let us see how we can bring order to the mind. Now, this brings us to the second point we are going to talk about, unminding the mind. In unminding the mind, and we are going to talk about carelessness. We are going a little bit deeper into it. The mind, when tied to the ego, leads to carelessness and culminates in callousness or not even caring with time. This is the important thing. We are not disengaging from life. All of that is not what yoga is asking for, and all of that is neither practical nor wise. But to be able to live life fully, to be able to be engaged and to engage life, but not to engage those habits which are not part of life and not conducive to better living or to spiritual ascent. That is wisdom. There is great loss, my friends, when the outer takes center stage, as the inner promptings are not heard anymore, and one's ability to discern or separate, differentiate between what's good for one's true development is impaired. We do not have to choose between the outer and the inner. As what we are talking about, what we are referring to, the outer and inner, where do we know these? Where does one know of things outside and of the happenings inside? Isn't it on the same plane, my friends, of awareness or consciousness? All of the outer is known in the inner. All of the inner is known in the inner. All of what's out there, you, me, all of those things out there are known in here, in the mind, in the awareness, in the consciousness. And all of the notions that we have, our likes, dislikes, and all the rest of it, are also known in the same field. So why is it not possible to observe that inner field or be aware of that inner field as a totality and not a fragment that mandates a choice. Carelessness, what we are talking about, is rooted in the subtle feelings of possessiveness. That's where it's rooted at. This is mine, this I prefer. All these are feelings of possessiveness. This I would like to avoid. These are the front end of this big, huge train of sorrow, which is hard to stop once it gets rolling. I understand, my friends, that we have to live in life and there are some aspirations, but everything has to be given some kind of gravity against something larger. See, my friends, there are some times when you want to buy something and you might temper that with, well, but I'm on a savings plan or something like that. You may want to eat something and you might say, I'm trying to lose weight. No, it's not the best for me. It's given gravity against what's all the things I want, I don't want, against what's good. That contrast has to be there to succeed in life. One has to be able to temper everything with contrast. This is what I see, this is all that, this is what I'm feeling prompted to do, indulgence, etc., against what's good. And that's what we are asking you to do. That's what yoga asks, nothing less. Gravity against all the resulting inner turmoil and degradation. And when that is there, there is no carelessness. The faulty wiring of what's in it for me, this I want, all of that stuff has got to be abandoned. Why do we need that to live an effective life? Can't we look at things, be aware of what's in it for our highest interest, and select on its basis without this whole gamut of likes and dislikes within that causes endless restlessness? Wouldn't it be nice to once and for all do away with inner restlessness? We want a break after working on a big, a tough week, a long week in our office or factory or wherever else. We want a break. We want to come home on a weekend and be free of some of that. Why can't we be free of some of that while we work? If we are working on the inner at the same time, we are using the outer to polish the inner, and everything contributes to your joy and our happiness. If we don't, it increases the inner restlessness, causes turmoil, and disallows even the simple joys and peace that we might experience. You cannot even enjoy a nice cup of tea or coffee without the mind grinding within. And that, my friends, is no way to live. This carelessness is the rope that ties the mind to the ego, and it all starts with simple, innocent notions as this is mine, this I like, this I don't like. Those are not part of life. We can enjoy a moment without that add-on of this I like or this I don't like, because those add-ons are going to form cravings and a sense of wanting to repel or repulse what we don't, or avoid what we don't like. Can't we enjoy something without that? Are those necessary? Is that buildup, that accumulation of likes and dislikes, necessary for you to enjoy something? Something really simple, friends. A little nice piece of chocolate. Do I have to have the I like and I want and I must have to enjoy chocolate? Can I enjoy chocolate without all of that? I know it's possible because a baby does it. You give them a little piece of chocolate, they enjoy it. After that, you give them a toy or something else, they enjoy that. Then you hold them and smile at them, and they smile right back. And they're not thinking about the chocolate. It's not that they didn't enjoy the chocolate, but they know how to enjoy the chocolate without being caught up in it with likes, dislikes, this I must have and this I must not have. We have forgotten some of that. And that is called conditioning. And yoga is a way to return to our true nature, which is the unconditioned self. So we are asked and we are even implored to do our best in all things that we undertake, but to wisely keep an eye on other things such as greed and ambition, which contrary to popular belief, do not support our doing or achieving the best. The selfish inner urges disallow or thwart potential because the mind constantly dwells on what's in it for me. See, my friends, when even part of the energy goes to all this, me, my interests, I, me, mine, and all of that, the energy is not being harnessed into action. Potential is not being harnessed. So as long as you have these things which are supposedly there to take care of our interests, it works against us. We have to see this very carefully and rewire the mind so it works well. What does what's in it for me, got to do with doing one's best? Does it have anything to do with that? If not, why do we have it? As simple as that. All things come when we do our best sooner or later. You need not worry about them. You need not run after them. It will come. See, my friends, the flower doesn't advertise that it's got pollen for the bees to come. The flower just does its thing. When it has pollen, the bees will come. There's no two ways about it. It doesn't have to publicize. It doesn't put up a banner or something. I haven't seen that. Maybe it does. A big banner saying, well, you know, pollen, now serving pollen, bees, please arrive. The flower doesn't do that. As simple as that. If there is pollen, the bees need something to make honey, and they will come. So why let thoughts of what's in it for me even come into the equation of doing one's best? Simply do one's best. The other stuff will catch up with you. It will come to you sooner or later. It's like that in the fabric of nature every place, my friends. Just look around. The focus on what's in it for me is a call to carelessness as the little me becomes the target of fulfillment. When you do what needs to be done, because it needs to be done, with all of your heart and mind, it's a job well done, and all the other things will catch up with you. When you run after all the other things, you don't do a good job, and less catches up with you. That is a flawed principle, a flawed way of living. Now, my friends, let's move on to samsara. We spoke about it a little bit earlier on. We try to speak about it now in a slightly different context. When the mind is tied to the ego sense and the notions of pleasure and pain, this is the seed for samsara or world illusion. What we call world experience, world illusion, all of that stuff. Let's try to put it together in a formula, a real simple formula that is easy to grasp and perhaps easy to remember. And you may even want to pause the video or something and write it down. It'll also be in our handout. Ego sense plus notions of pleasure and pain equal to samsara or world illusion. As simple as that. We'll say it one more time. Ego sense plus notions of pleasure and pain equal to samsara or world illusion. Living an awakened life stops watering the roots of samsara and all of that is going to keep us from suffering. Challenging habit by asking yourself, just why do I need all these notions about anything and anyone at all? Why do I need them? I'm awake. When the situation comes, I'm going to handle it. There are some things that do require prior planning. That prior planning is part of the action process because it is needed to accomplish something. But we are talking about all this activity, psychic activity, that never leads to action, that may never materialize, that may never come to be. It's just spinning one's wheels, thinking we are accomplishing something, but going nowhere. It's all of that that needs to be stopped. And that, my friends, is restlessness that causes more restlessness and leads to delusion. Ask yourself, my friends, am I not capable of living better without all this turmoil? If you sincerely keep all these questions in your heart and try to go about your life consciously, you will see that life is better lived without them. And the weight of all of them will soon be off your shoulders, and life would take on a lighter way, a sort of enlightened way. Now, my friends, let us talk about the fourth thing in exhausting all this, which is equanimity. The mind that is not swayed by pleasure and pain, honor and dishonor, and all of these calamities, experiences equanimity. The mind that is not swayed. Why does the mind have to be swayed? Where do these things that sway the mind, where do they reside? This is pleasure, this is pain, this is good, this is not. Is that, my friends, ask yourself, is that part of what's out there? If it's part of what's out there, I can't change it. But if it's part of what's in here, if it's all in here, I can change it and I should change it. Why should my mind be swayed at all? Can I not deal with things, live life without the mind being swayed? Is there not enough to do with dealing with all of the ups and downs of life without creating ups and downs in ourselves to contribute to all that? Ask yourself, is there not enough salt in the dish of life that I need to keep adding to it? This swaying, my friends, is an effect, and it is not part of the situation. These are all habitual reactions of the mind. They are not part of the fabric of life. They are the mind's fabric. They're mind's reactions to events that occur quite naturally. The non-recognition of things as they are is ignorance or foolishness. Plain and simple, nothing else. The non-recognition is foolishness. This foolishness and ignorance, in our political times, it has become a sort of condescending term when we say you're foolish or something like that. Oh, my feelings are hurt. That person has said something so drastic. This political correctness and all of that is going to prevent us from even coming to the heart of things that are important. All of that needs to be set aside. It makes no sense at all. All that linguistic sort of combat and jugglery that people have got into, that is, it's not useful to us at all. So let's set all that aside. We're talking about it in its essential nature. The non-recognition of things as they are is ignorance or foolishness. It's ignorance because the truth is not seen. So there is ignorance because there is no knowledge of things as they are. And it's foolish because we deny ourselves what is good, happiness or true nature, all of that. And we subject ourselves to something that is not good. That's foolish. To cause ourselves hurt is foolish. If you take a hammer and hit your hand, that's foolish. If you take the hammer off this carelessness and hit your mind, that's foolish. There's no two ways about it. Or see, all that political correctness has to be completely set aside because all that linguistic mumbo jumbo garbage, it doesn't do anything. And it's just garbage, my friends. It needs to be taken away, carted away, left by the curbside so it can be taken away. See, you don't even have to do anything about it. You embrace wisdom, you embrace awakened living, the other stuff weakens by disuse. It's the best way of recycling, getting rid of all of that. Just do what's good. Go from good to better to best. And all the other stuff will be recycled in nature's own way. Isn't that grand? The destruction of the mind, my friends, is therefore not a loss, but it's a gain, as we are talking about the destruction of our likes, our dislikes, and all of our conditioning, which has nothing at all to do with things out there. It, matter of fact, prevents us from knowing what's out there as it is. This requires relentless vigilance, and it requires this mind that is awakened to be enabled, to be empowered, because remember what we said before, the inner and outer are seen in the same field of view, are known in the same field of view. So when one is awakened, one does what needs to be done while being aware of these habitual surges without being caught up or without being swayed by them. The inner urges or impulses are vasana that we spoke about earlier, the seed of the mind. They will rise. They have gained strength by use, and they will weaken by disuse. As these vasana or conditioning, as they weaken, at the same time, if we are engaging life actively, which is dealing with things as they are and doing our best because it needs to be done, not because of what's in it for me, the I starts becoming weaker and weaker, and along with that, all of its other baggage, I like, I don't like. So there's a serious movement going on within, which allows us to do what needs to be done, at the same time to exhaust all of this conditioning and carelessness and foolishness within us. So as the vasana or subtle habits weaken, there is a proportional increase of sattva or inner goodness. Remember, my friends, we spoke about sattva or inner goodness the last time. Matter of fact, the last two times in number 11 and number 12. So there's a proportional increase in this inner goodness. At the same time, noble qualities like friendliness and others that we have also spoken about rise in us very naturally. So now we understand why it's so important to live an awakened life. We'll talk about vasanas a little later. One naturally does what has to be done or what needs to be done when it needs to be done and in the manner it needs to be done, in the best way it can be done, only when the mind is in equanimity and not swayed by the rise and fall of conditioning. As long as there is conditioning, we cannot do any of this. We cannot do anything well. We cannot do things wholeheartedly. Some part of our mind is concerned about how will others take it? What's in it for me? How will this work out? Some part that's looking ahead, looking to the side, looking to the other side, looking back, looking all around. This part that is supposed to watch out for our best interests is itself thwarting or limiting potential and performance. That's why it's a flawed formula, my friends. That stuff needs to be tossed. As simple as that. Awakened living allows you to do what needs to be done on its own merit because it needs to be done wholehearted. This is a big thing to ask yourself. In my work day today or yesterday, if it's late where you live, when you are watching right now, what are all the things that I did because they needed to be done with all of my heart and soul and body and mind? What are the things that I did in that manner without all the what's in it for me or how will it be taken or some other motive driving my actions, whether it be in the office or at home or any place else? Just ask yourself these questions, and the urge for a better way to live will arise in you. There has to be a better way. Why should the inner grinding motivate my actions? Why should I not be able to do things on their own merit because it needs to be done? It's as simple as that.
Let us summarize what we have talked about today. We address two main topics, the seeds for samsara in the mind and unminding the mind, the things that cause the problems and some ways in which we can reverse this process and go into joyful and enlightened living. Under seeds for samsara in the mind, we talked about prana or life force, and we talked about vasana or mental conditioning. Put quite simply, there must be an energy that powers all this conditioning and makes it come alive and seem so vehement and real. And therefore, learning to regulate that energy and being aware of this conditioning while making better choices has to be the way out of all this. And for that, we broke it down a little bit more in the second half when we talked about unminding the mind. We spoke about spiritual discipline. My friends, spiritual discipline is not punitive, but positive. It doesn't deny you something or suppress anything. It simply says, hey friend, better choices instead. That's all. Avoiding carelessness, which is avoiding the pitfalls of habit. We came back into samsara and looked at ways about enlightened living. And last of all, we talked about equanimity. So, to put it all in a nutshell, my friends, we covered the seeds for samsara and the mind, prana or life force, and vasana or mental conditioning, and also unminding the mind. We didn't talk a whole lot about prana in terms of the practices of pranayama, because in some of the other videos I have on yoga, I have covered these as the limbs of yoga, both the prana, pranayama, some of the asanas and things that come about, and also the concentration and meditation, where we include prana along with our meditation and the mantra. So there was no need to cover it here. These things are on the website and on YouTube. Next time, we will continue with the important teachings in the fifth chapter. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or PDF handout, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.